Good morning. It is time to get up with LeBron James, the king, with a strong statement about the NBA's return. We're on it right off the top. Then we've got all the details on all the decisions they made in Green Bay. Wait until you hear why they did what they did in the draft. And then this weekend's dance card is filled. In this hour, you will hear of the one team that could have ended Michael's run and totally rewritten basketball history. All that and more as we get up with you on a Friday from Bristol. Mike Greenberg here, and so delighted that you are there and have chosen to get up with us as we work our way through another week and the beginning of another month. And here's hoping it'll be one to remember for all of us. Again, as sports fans, we're getting through this thing together and a very busy morning we have. Let's get up and go, and it starts with this. The 2020 Little League World Series was canceled yesterday as a result of the coronavirus pandemic. That event had been held every August since 1947, had never been canceled before. Elsewhere, NASCAR announcing yesterday it will resume its season without fans starting May 17th at Darlington Raceway in South Carolina. From there, NASCAR plans on holding 7 total races over an 11-day span. Hockey NHL Commissioner Gary Bettman says the league is considering starting the season for next year as late as December, as it considers all options to finish this current season. However, no firm timeline or target dates have been established. And LeBron James was on Twitter yesterday coming out against reports he had seen that suggested there were NBA executives and agents who want to cancel the season. Here's LeBron's tweet. Saw some reports about execs and agents wanting to cancel season. That's absolutely not true. Nobody I know saying anything like that. As soon as it's safe, we would like to finish our season. I'm ready and our team is ready. Nobody should be canceling anything. Well, let's get a little further into that for a moment. Adrian Wojnarowski is here with us. Woj, it is May 1st, which is a date that we have been pointing to, perhaps somewhat arbitrarily, for quite some time. Where do we stand as of right now with the possibility of the season resuming?
Greeny, infectious disease specialists who advise the NBA, other professional sports teams, I think anybody in our country right now, the message that they've given those people making decisions is this: hold off on having to make decisions until the final possible moment. And that's what the NBA is doing here. May 1st was kind of a date that Adam Silver put out a few weeks ago is really the very beginning of when the league would have to start, you know, considering decisions on the future of not only this season, but next season. And listen, the NBA still, from ownership level, commissioner's office, teams, players, the Players Association, they want to find a way to finish the season. But not are they only working on this season, but next season. What does the NBA calendar look like going forward? You know, there's a lot of support in the NBA to move the start of next season to just prior to Christmas. And that's whether they finish this season or not. Because at the very least next year, it gives the NBA more time, more of an opportunity to be able to get fans in the arenas moving forward. And that's going to be important for the financial solvency of the league.
And very quickly, I saw a couple of different things yesterday. We just showed LeBron's tweet. I saw Mark Cuban in an interview saying he is confident, I think is the word he used, that we will see this season pick up, although probably without fans. What's the single biggest challenge the commissioner has right now?
The safety of the players, the coaches, the staff. Can they put them in an environment where they're going to minimize the risk? And remember, it's not just the safety of the players. You have coaches, you know, who are in their late 60s, early 70s on staff that would be around players at all times and certainly would be susceptible to the virus. That's a concern of not just, you know, the league office, but teams and organizations themselves, all the support staff around. There is a lot to consider and a lot for the NBA to be able to have confidence with before they put their entire league back in an environment and try to grind out a playoffs and crown a champion, which is something Adam Silver, you know, very much wants to do.
Not rooting for the best. Woj, have a great weekend, my man. Thank you very much. And we'll check in with you on Monday. To the NFL now. Thanks, where the fallout continues from the Packers' surprising selection of quarterback Jordan Love in the first round last Thursday. Our Packers reporter, Rob Domofsky, has a very interesting article that is up right now talking about the insides of how Green Bay came to this decision to trade up for Aaron Rodgers' potential replacement. We'll make it this morning's required reading. Rob writes, so even with obvious holes on the offense, topped by the lack of a proven number two receiver behind Davante Adams, Gutekunst, that's the GM, admittedly weighed the short-term and long-term gains and believed that better value was in the long-term with Love, whether LaFleur, the coach, liked it or not. A first-round quarterback, in theory, wouldn't help LaFleur get over that hump one iota, but how could a young coach fight it? The answer, he couldn't or he didn't. Let's get more now as Rob Domofsky joins us here. Again, covering the Packers, wrote the article. Rob, the piece has a great deal of detail. In the end, what should we take away from the decision they made to take the quarterback?
Yeah, Greeny, it was general manager Brian Gutekunst's decision, and it had to be, because that's the way the Packers are structured. Here's what I can tell you about how it happened. I'm told the Packers loved the top, the very top of the receiver class, but the only one they had any realistic shot at was LSU's Justin Jefferson. But once he went off the board to the Vikings at number 22, that's when Gutekunst really zeroed in on Love. A source told me going into the draft that there was a 50% chance Love would end up as a Packer. Gutekunst first had his eye on him as far back as October. He actually went and saw him in person play a game against LSU the night before the Packers played the Cowboys. He then rejoined the team in Dallas the next day. And the more he watched him, the more he thought he had the potential, Greeny, to be a rare combination of Brett Favre's gunslinging, Aaron Rodgers' intelligence, and a Patrick Mahomes-like athleticism. Of course, he had to ask Matt LaFleur, his coach, to evaluate him, but in the end, it was Gutekunst's call.
Okay, a couple of other things I want to get in quickly here. I get that they didn't take a receiver in the first round, but a record 36 receivers were drafted this past weekend. Why didn't they take one of them anywhere?
Yeah, a couple that they had their eye on in day two fell off the board right before they were up. In fact, Denzel Mims from Baylor, a guy they really liked, went three spots before their pick in the second round. And yes, a record 36 did go, but Gutekunst told us after the draft that he didn't think it was as deep a receiver class as everyone else did. He liked the talent at the top, but once they got through the first couple of rounds, he said he did not think there was anyone in the draft that could beat out anybody behind Davante Adams on his roster.
All right, and then quickly, interestingly, we have heard from Brett Favre on this, and we have not heard from Aaron Rodgers on this. What do we know about Aaron?
Well, look, until we hear from him himself, it's all speculation. But the Packers, I can tell you this, they don't think that Rodgers is going to be a problem. They don't think he's going to cause issues in the locker room. They think he's going to be willing to mentor Love. And that's based on their conversations with him in the immediate aftermath of the pick. The thing that Favre brought up, and it's worth noting, is how long Rodgers is willing to do that, given that he knows that the clock is ticking on his time with this draft pick.
All right, great work, Rob. Thank you very much. Again, the full story is up right now, and you should definitely check it out on ESPN.com. Meanwhile, my guys are up early. Let's go with Marcus Spears and Bobby Carpenter this morning. And so, Swagoo, I'll start with you. As you listened to all of that, what do you take away from the conversation we just had and all the new detail in this story?
Well, it'll be interesting, G, for me to see how Aaron Rodgers responds when the reality of getting back to football and being in a locker room. And what about the frustration when you don't feel like you have the receivers based off the play in practice or in camp, if we're fortunate enough to have one and into the season? What about week three or four when you're not having enough production on the outside? That is when the real season begins. And obviously I've talked about this team being 13-3 last year and using Jones out of the backfield a lot in the receiver role. But if Aaron Rodgers is not happy, this will be a long, tumultuous season. And you think about this in locker rooms, and Bobby can speak to this, there are temperature guys. There are guys that kind of control the vibe, the things that transpire in the locker room as far as the undertones of what dudes are talking about. And I'm pretty sure that that guy in Green Bay is Aaron Rodgers. So if this is not something that he's willing to embrace and something that he's going to make okay for the rest of the guys on the roster, Green Bay is in for a long season.
How concerned are you about that, Bob?
You know, it's a real concern because you look at this. You know, Matt LaFleur didn't draft Jordan Love, but he did sign off on him. He was part of the evaluation process. And just like Spears said, you know, Aaron Rodgers is one of those temperature guys. You're essentially now asking Matt LaFleur, who's a young coach, who's 4 years older than Aaron Rodgers, to be Phil Jackson and to try to take one of the greatest players in the game, who's obviously unhappy, and try to massage this thing and massage his ego to make sure that he's going to be on board. We're watching The Last Dance right now. We're watching this thing in real time. But now you're asking a guy who's significantly younger, who doesn't have the coaching experience, to walk in and go talk to his veteran quarterback and try to get him on the same page. And as Spears said, when this thing, if it struggles at all during the season, don't think Aaron's not going to bring up the fact that they didn't get him any help when they had the opportunity to do so.
That's a very interesting and important point, I think. And Marcus, I would throw it back to you on that. We don't get the sense that Matt LaFleur and Aaron Rodgers had the greatest relationship anyway. I guess we don't know it for certain. How does the coach put this thing together so that it works?
Gee, it's got to be a lot of, I want to say communication, but it's got to be a lot of coddling. Like, and I hate to use that word when we talk about in terms of men doing their job, but in these particular, these are very, like, this is a sensitive spot. Like, you're telling a quarterback that's up there in age that I'm about to move on from you at some point. And that some point could be sooner rather than later. But also, I need you to play well and win games. So there has to be a fine line with Matt LaFleur and how he approaches Aaron Rodgers. And the thing is about football play, it can't be fake, G. Like, it's got to be, they have to find some kind of rapport that's real and true to who both of them are to make sure that they can work well together. If not, it'll be built on fakeness, and the fakeness will eventually catch up to Matt LaFleur, I think, more so than Aaron Rodgers. Because people will be salivating thinking that they can get Aaron Rodgers in a trade or if he's disgruntled after this season is over with.
Yeah, look, there's an old expression. You're out of the business 2 years before you know you're out of the business. In this case, Aaron Rodgers is out of the Packers 2 years before he's actually out of the Packers. But the difference is he knows it. All right, we're just getting started this morning. Coming up here on Get Up, The Cowboys have a reason for not locking up Dak Prescott to a long-term deal yet. Is Swagoo buying their explanation? You will find out. Coming up next, it's Swagoo Says. And then, if there is a national champion crowned in college football next year, the road to that title may look very, very different. You'll hear why. As we continue, it's Get Up on a Friday on ESPN.
It's your home speaking, and I need you to do me a couple of favors. First, could you get that blueberry that rolled under the fridge last week? It's throwing my feng shui off. Second thing, bundle your home and car insurance with GEICO. It's easy, and we could save money. Lastly, I know you were thinking of painting the nursery back to off-white, but I'm actually feeling this baby blue. Didn't think it was my color, but I am pulling it off.
GEICO. For bundling made easy, go to geico.com today.
Foot odor throwing you off your game? Stick to a winning game plan with Odor Eaters, featuring three advanced odor and wetness fighters. The lineup provides long-lasting odor control plus more to keep your feet on their game.
Odor Eaters powder provides outstanding moisture control. Clear drying spray is the MVP in preventing athlete's foot, while insoles work continuously to manage wetness while adding a layer of comfort. Pick up today at Walmart, Target, CVS, Dollar General, or other fine retailers.
Odor Eaters. Destroy foot odor with the best in odor defense.
Get Up is brought to you by Disney Plus. All of your favorites all in one place. Sign up today. What does Swagoo say?
G, you know what I say? I say Daniel Jones is a gangster.
He lying, G. Look at me today, G.
I'm already a beast, so we just gonna be beastie. I call you bro.
Yes.
You are my bro. Are you crying, son?
This is not exactly how I meant for this to go.
Take that and smoke it.
We call it Swagoo Says because no one says things quite like he does. Quickly, what did you say to me when we were testing our microphones this morning, Swagoo?
I said, if I had your hand, I'd cut mine off, G. That's what my grandfather used to tell me all the time, man. That just means you doing way better than me, playboy.
I have no idea what it means, but I love everything about it. Okay, let's get right to it. You're going to decipher what other people are saying. This was Stephen Jones of the Dallas Cowboys front office and ownership talking about Dak Prescott earlier this week.
Dak's our guy. I mean, we think no one thinks more of Dak Prescott than Jerry Jones and myself. I know Mike, when he signed on for it, part of why he signed on was Dak Prescott. And, you know, it's just getting it done. I mean, the bigger these deals get, the harder they get. We believe in our track record of getting players signed. I totally believe we'll get Dak signed at the right number that's good for Dak, good for the Cowboys, good for this team. We're all motivated to win. We will certainly want Dak to be happy, but we also want to surround him with great football players.
That is what Stephen Jones said. What does Swagoo say?
Yada, yada, yada. We gonna sign Dak. Yada, 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 yada. We want him around. Blah, blah, blah. We gonna get it done. Blah, blah, blah. The bigger they get, sign the man.
Okay, that might be my new favorite one. Let's move on to Jameis Winston, who was talking about joining the New Orleans Saints. Here's what Jameis said.
Being a quarterback, you have to be a student of the game. So now I actually get a chance to dive into that more, and I actually have a Hall of Fame quarterback that I'm learning from, opposed to trying to learn by myself or use Google.
Use Google. That's what Jameis said. Swagoo, what do you say?
I ain't have a damn coach ever when I was in Tampa Bay. This man said Google, G. First of all, I'm trying to process this. You should never in a million years playing professional football say you need an outside source to get coached. Man, I feel so bad for, I feel bad about everything I've ever said about Jameis Winston. The man said Google. God bless you, Jameis Winston. Google couldn't have got me through my NFL career either, bro.
All right, one more here, and this, of course, was the most talked about soundbite of the week. This was Brett Favre talking about Aaron Rodgers.
Google.
And I think Aaron will finish somewhere else. That's my gut. Guarantee you this, and I don't know this for certain, but I guarantee you it's got the wheels turning in Aaron's mind, which if that's the case, then that means that there's a chip on his shoulder towards the organization that otherwise was not there. And so all he needs is a reason other than this reason to expedite that.
That's what Brett Favre said. What does Swagoo say?
I get it, Brett. And in other words, G, like you said, let me cipher. I'm the best damn this is Brett Favre. I'm the best damn quarterback in Green Bay Packers history. You know if I had to leave, you know damn well Aaron Rodgers gonna have to leave before his time is up. That's basically what he's saying. And the franchise is in a situation right now where they gonna do him just like he did me, and now he know why I was so mad when they drafted him 25.
That was an all-world episode of Swagoo Says This Week, where Marcus Spears interprets what the people in sports really mean when they are they are flapping their gums. Google,
G.
All right. Meanwhile, it is going to be a great weekend. And I'll tell you one of the reasons why, because we've got The Last Dance again this weekend. Episodes 5 and 6. After last weekend in 3 and 4, they made waves all week long. There was a lot to unpack. In particular, I thought about Dennis Rodman from those recent episodes. And who better to help with that than one of Rodman's former teammates? And here he is, one of the best dancers in that Last Dance. He is now one of the voices of the Bulls on the radio in Chicago and one of my absolute favorite people to cover back when he was a member of those Chicago Bulls and the second three-peat team. Bill Wennington is with me here. And, Bill, I appreciate you doing this. And, you know, last week's episodes, so much of it was focused on the Bad Boy Pistons that what got buried under it a little bit, unimaginably, were the antics of Dennis Rodman. Somehow the fact that Dennis Rodman took a vacation during a season and went to Vegas with Carmen Electra became the second highlight. What do you remember about that time when Dennis went away?
Well, I do remember him leaving. Like, he was in the building and then he just left. And I was like, well, where's he going? And Phil comes down and says, give Dennis a little bit of time off. He's got 48 hours, which we kind of all knew was going to get extended. And then when we found out he was going to Vegas, then it was Dennis just being Dennis. But we also understood, you know, as a player on the team, you know, there are different rules for different players. Some guys can do more than others. Obviously, Michael, Scotty were treated differently and Dennis as well. But we also knew that we needed Dennis to play. And if Dennis needed a little bit of time off and needed to blow off some steam, so to speak, then that was fine. That was cool with us because we knew when he came back, he was going to be ready to play. And
something I've said many times since those days was that Rodman's antics made him a star, a superstar, but they also obscured how good he was. I think sometimes people think of him only for the crazy stuff and don't remember how good he was. How good was Dennis Rodman as a player?
absolutely phenomenal. I mean, they listed him at 6'9". He was 6'8". And to lead the league in rebounding 7 years in a row and to play position defense the way he did on a variety of players, from guys that were 6'2", 6'3", to Shaquille O'Neal at 7'2", and 320, 340 pounds, is absolutely amazing. And one of the great nights, Greeny, if I can share the story, is we're out in Miami after the Miami game, and we're at an establishment. And Terry Armour, who covered the Bulls for the Tribune at the time, was in talking to Dennis, and Tony Kukoc was there, myself and Johnny Redkerr, and we're just chit-chatting and talking about basketball. And Terry was grilling him about basketball and what Dennis has watched is for and how he plays the game and position and spacing and just running the floor and hustling. Terry left that evening, and I was talking to him, and he goes, "I did not know how smart that man was and how much basketball he really knew and how much attention he pays to the game, because everyone is just worried about what he's doing off the court, and that does take away from his basketball legacy."
And one last question for you here, Bill. The most famous basket you ever scored, I guess, did not come in a championship season. It came as the punctuation that night in the Garden off that feed from Michael on the night that he scored 55, the legendary double nickel game. But when we look back on the last dance, on that last championship year, 97-98, what's the one memory that stands out for you the most?
Just that that team was so close-knit together that no matter what the distractions were, we were mature enough to understand what the ultimate goal was. Phil was the best coach and the perfect coach to coach all those people and egos and keep everyone in line. And just how hard we really did have to work to stay focused on the task at hand and winning. And it was a great team to be a part of and a great bunch of guys.
Bill, it's a pleasure to see you again after all of these years. Thank you very much for your perspective here. Stay safe, and I look forward to hearing you calling Bulls basketball as soon as they can get back on the floor.
Thank you, Greeny. All the best. You stay safe too, brother.
All right. And again, don't miss it. The Last Dance coming up Sunday, episodes 5 and 6. I've seen them. They're fabulous. We will have Charles Barkley here talking about them with us Monday morning on Get Up. It's Last Dance this Sunday night on ESPN. Coming up, was the blueprint for the 2020 college football season laid out yesterday? You'll hear what one very powerful commissioner said, and we'll tell you exactly what it meant in just a moment. You're watching Get Up on ESPN.
Though we're apart these days, we're sharing more. So, at GEICO, we'd like to say thanks. Thanks for sharing your savage dance moves. Thanks for sharing your DIY haircut fails. Thanks for sharing your inner lip sync star. Now, it's our turn to share with the GEICO Give Back, a 15% credit on car and motorcycle policies for current and new customers. Because we're committed for the long haul, the 15% credit lasts your full policy term. Visit geico.com/giveback for more info and eligibility.
We are back on Get Up. And, of course, one of the big stories out of the NFL this week, quarterback Jameis Winston signing with the Saints. It's 1 year. It's $1.1 million. Now, without naming any specific teams, Jameis said he had other opportunities that might have paid him more money or given him a better chance to start, which makes his decision even more interesting. So for much more, let's bring in our NFL reporter, Diana Russini. Diana, it's been too long. What can you tell us about the other teams that were interested in Jameis Winston?
I know, Greeny. It's so nice to talk to you. And I wish I could say I was thinking about something really important when I heard this news, but I actually thought of you because you've been the one on this Jameis Winston train of how can he not find a job? Well, we obviously know he landed in probably one of the best quarterback rooms ever with Drew Brees, Taysom Hill, and Sean Payton leading that offense. But before we got there, there were teams interested. The Jacksonville Jaguars threw a line into his camp to sort of get a sense, and they were told the price was going to be too high for them to land him. So in terms of the market for Jameis, there certainly was one. But he has said publicly that he turned down bigger money to play with the New Orleans Saints. And when you reflect on it and you start looking at those teams that were interested, it makes a lot of sense that teams were willing to spend more. But for him, this was about proving that he can play and he can be a starter again and to learn from the best, a future Hall of Famer in Drew Brees.
Yeah, and you're so connected there in New Orleans. I'd be curious because they talk all the time about how much they love Taysom Hill. But if Drew Brees, as he did last year, suffers an injury and misses 4 weeks, who's their starting quarterback?
They go to Jameis Winston at that point. The way they use Taysom Hill right now in this offense is really just for all his variety, for gadgets. And while Sean Payton will say to, he is blue in the face, that Taysom Hill is your starter. He is your guy. We saw that contract that they paid him. He obviously believes that he can do this. But this is going to be a Jameis Winston gig if Drew Brees was to get hurt.
All right, Diana, stay close. We'll get back with you soon. Have a wonderful weekend. Thank you very much. For that. Now, in the meantime, I want to go from the NFL to the college football, because this is the thing that I've been talking about for now, I feel like forever. The state of the upcoming season is still very much up in the air because states and universities are dealing with the coronavirus pandemic, and it isn't the same for any two necessarily. I want you to hear what the SEC commissioner said yesterday on the radio in Jacksonville.
There is room for different conferences to make different decisions, but we're all interconnected. We are playing basketball tournaments, there's no connection. We're all in our arenas playing each other. And so the hypotheticals that play out if different decisions are made are where those increments come in. If there's a couple of programs that aren't able, does that stop everyone? I'm not sure it does, but the ability for us to stay connected, I think, will remain important.
This is the comment we've been waiting for. Swagoo is back and joining us now. Laura Rutledge and Damian Woody are here. And Laura, I'll start with you because we have been talking about this on the show, it feels like, for weeks now. And you have been talking to a lot of people around college football. Let's make sure we're correctly interpreting what Sankey is saying. He's basically saying if some schools can play and others can't, those who can are going to go ahead and play football.
That's it. And look, I mean, Commissioner Sankey and all these other commissioners will continue to say that they're going to try to just start this football season on time. And they're going to try to get their players back on campus if it makes sense for them sometime in the middle of July. So they'd have a 6-week time period to get ready for the season. That's the ideal. That is one of the plans that's being discussed. But one of the other plans that has been discussed and might be thrown out there is, hey, if it is a regional situation where it's safe to play for some commissioners and some conferences, then they may say, all right, we're going to try and go. I think at the end of the day, what we're talking about here is just for public universities in Power Five conferences, it's over $4 billion at stake. They are going to try as hard as they can to try and play football. And people say, well, the players aren't being paid and all of that. I get it. What we're talking about is the viability of these universities and the 35 other sports that make less combined than college football alone. This is a revenue that is important for these schools, and it's something as well that they need to have fans in the stands for. So however they can make that happen, even if it means playing themselves in some regions of the country, it's not out of the question.
Quickly, I want to make sure, because you've spoken to a lot of people, it's one thing to say the SEC can play, the Big Ten can't, so the SEC will, the Big Ten won't. The SEC is spread out over 11 states. The Big Ten is spread out over 11 states. We could be looking at a situation where some teams in a conference can't play. Do you see a scenario where the teams that can go on ahead even without the other schools in their same conference?
That's absolutely worst case scenario, Greeny. They do not want to go that route. It's already something that they'd like to see this unified across the country. If that's not possible, they really do not want to get to a point where they have an outlier state that has a school that's not able to compete. I would say that is very low on the list of probability.
All right. So Damian Woody, I'll come to you here. You went to Boston College. That's in a major metropolitan area. It's completely different circumstance from that of a lot of the other schools that would be in the ACC right now. What do you think of all this?
Well, I mean, Green, the first thought that came to my mind is who has the best interest of the students in this particular case? Laura brought up the money aspect, which I think is playing huge. Talking about this is a multi-billion dollar business, which is college football. OK, everyone has a vested interest in getting college football back, from the NCAA to the schools to the coaches. But what about the students? What about the athletes? Is it safe to bring these guys back? Because if you don't have the students back in school, you know, how do you justify having the athletes, you know, back practicing and getting ready for a season? So who is working on behalf of the student athletes to make sure that they're in a very safe environment?
And listen, Marcus, as we sit here on a week where the NCAA is finally for the first time acknowledging name, image and likeness, and every conversation we have, Laura's throwing out the number $4 billion, and that doesn't even encompass everyone. The notion that this isn't a business dies forever with this circumstance. Yes.
Gee, you know foundationally where my mind goes. Like, and let me say this too. To that question, to that answer that Laura said about being the worst case scenario that some teams play and some teams don't within the conference. Guess what they gonna do if they can do that? They're going to play. And they're going to probably try to figure out a way to share some of that revenue with the teams that can't participate. Because look, you are, this is about monetization. This is about making sure that colleges survive, making sure that athletic programs survive. So if there is any way, and I'll go back to when we first started talking about this, to get this done, whether it's 11 of the 14 SEC schools or nine of the schools of 12 in whatever conference, they are going to play if that is all possible and probably share the revenue to monetize everybody else in that conference.
All right, guys, stay close because we're going to come back to this conversation a little later. But first, you know, it's a Friday. I feel like we all need a laugh. So let's all laugh a little bit together here. NFL teams are running virtual meetings this week, and the Seattle Seahawks had a special surprise guest.
I want to welcome in Greg Olson. Greg, could you come in and tell the fellas what you're all about?
Yes.
Yeah. Coach, thanks so much. So excited to be here. I've been, you know, what I did mostly for Carolina is I drew up all my own plays. So I'm going to be adding a lot to the playbook. This one I just drew up, it's called 90 Go Flywheel Kanye Starburst. Look, I know what you're thinking. I'm an older guy. I'm 36. But I've been working out. Don't worry. I mean, does this look like the body of a 36-year-old? I don't think so. I don't think so.
D. Wood, your reaction.
Man, Will Ferrell always gets me, man. And then all of a sudden he pulls up his shirt, man, and show up that keg, man. It's man, that's so funny, man. You need a little bit of that.
Marcus?
Hell no. Shout out to Greg Olson, man. That's a good one. That's a good one, G.
Most of the time, a keg is the apt description. In his case, I think it's the entire bar. One way or the other, that was very well done. All right, much more to come as we continue. Spoiler alert. The Last Dance ends with the Bulls' sixth and last championship in 1998. But coming up next, you're going to find out just how close they came to not even getting there. And it's going to lead us directly to our sneaky hembo for the morning. Who was the second leading scorer in the legendary 98 Eastern Conference Final behind Michael Jordan? Jalen Rose played in that series. He will answer that question next with you. Get Up on ESPN.
Hello, this is your apartment. I need some favors from you. Your cat keeps rubbing against the kitchen island and I can't return the favor. Can you give her extra pets for me? After that, could you bundle your renters and car insurance with Geico? We could save money, and it's easy to do online. And one last thing. Could you leave the TV on during the day? I need to catch up on my soaps.
Geico. For bundling made easy, go to geico.com today.
We're back on Get Up. We're about to talk about the legendary 1998 Eastern Conference Finals between the Pacers and Bulls. Jalen Rose played in that series. So, Jalen, I'm telling you right now, Michael Jordan led all scorers in that series. Not a surprise. Who was the second leading scorer in that series?
I know this is definitely a trick question because it should be the Hall of Famer Reggie Miller or even Scottie Pippen. But I'm going to go deeper into the box score and say the waiter, Tony Kukoc.
You know what? It's not a bad guess, but you outthought yourself. It was Reggie Miller. Reggie Miller scored 122 points in that series. Scottie Pippen right behind him. Rick Smits was right behind them. And then came Kukoc. Now, we want to talk about this morning, Jalen, in part because today on ESPN.com, our friend Zach Lowe has a fascinating piece detailing Game 7 of that series. It came awfully close to derailing Chicago's second three-peat. The Bulls, of course, would win the game. They would go on to win their last championship. This was sort of the pinnacle of the Last Dance. And so with Jalen here, and Zach Lowe joins us this morning as well, because, Zach, I remember that game like it was being played yesterday. It was a tremendous game, and the stakes could not possibly have been higher. So as you went through your research and your recollections from that game, how would you describe how much it meant to the history of the sport?
Well, it's just another team that Michael denied, right? And it's a team that had lost in the Eastern Conference Finals both years that Michael was playing baseball, or the second year he had just come back. So for them, they felt like they had missed an opportunity to get to the finals when Michael was out or not 100%. And this was their chance. They felt that the Bulls were vulnerable and aging and old, and they got so close. I mean, Jalen will talk about how close they got there, ahead by 13 points early. And it's just another what if for all the players who got denied a ring because of Michael Jordan's greatness.
Jalen, as you think back on that series and that game in particular, what emotion comes immediately to you?
Well, I'm just happy that our Pacers are wearing that blue and gold ball head, black shoes, and black socks. Brought that to the NBA. I was just a bug on the windshield, Greeny. Happy to be there as a young player. So many amazing Hall of Famers at what they do. You got Phil Jackson, Michael Jordan, Scottie Pippen, Dennis Rodman, Tony Kukoc. You put Jeb Bushler on me, I'm going to take a bucket, as you see right there. On the other side, Reggie Miller, Mark Jackson, Chris Mullin, Larry Bird on the sideline with a young Rick Carlisle. And so just to have the opportunity to be in the game, in the building, was a total honor.
Did your team feel like it should have won?
Absolutely. No question about it. That's the beauty of sports, Greeny. While the rest of the world is celebrating Michael and the Bulls and their greatness, and rightfully so, we're about to upset the apple cart. That's exactly what we think. We played them 11 times that year. They won 6. We won 5. It was actually that close.
It was 5-5 going into that decisive game 7. And again, the Pacers led a lot of the way. Zach, I remember watching that game thinking to myself, the Bulls are going to lose. This is actually going to happen. They're going to lose. Do you think much about how history would have been different if Chicago, and in particular Jordan, don't win that series?
I don't think about it that much because it was really going to be one year, right? It was one championship. It's one team that's going to win a championship. But I'm with you, Greeny. The reason I've always been fascinated with this game and wanting to revisit it, it was the only game of the 6 title runs I remember ever feeling, holy cow, they might lose. A Michael Jordan team might lose. It was like a completely new emotion. And I vividly remember sitting on my couch thinking, I've never felt this way before. And I just want to give props to Jalen and the Pacers because in my head, they were ahead the whole game, and Michael came back at the end and stole the game for the Bulls. And that's not what happened. The Bulls were ahead by 8 in the third quarter. And how many times have we seen that same game where the home team just sort of goes on to win by 10, 11, 12? For the Pacers to punch back and take the lead on the road in the fourth quarter, that is a tough, tough team. And a team I always really liked, actually. I had a sweet spot for that team.
Jalen, why do you look so pained?
Because the world wouldn't be much different if Michael Jordan had 5 championships and I had 1. It wouldn't be much different.
It would. And here's why, Jalen, I have to disagree. The greatness of Jordan, the reason that he is placed on the pedestal that he is by those of us who will always put him ahead of LeBron, is that he never lost. He never lost. From the time he started winning, he never lost, Jalen. If he loses in that conference final, it makes a difference, Jalen. I think it does.
And he doesn't have 2 three-peats. From 2010 to 2020, LeBron James has won 3 championships. Michael Jordan has 2 three-peats. So I agree with you. Had we ended that run, then we would be talking about things probably a lot different. Man, it just pains me to think that we had a double-digit lead at Chicago in Game 7. Oh, man.
It was a brilliant game. And Zach's piece is fabulous. It's up right now on ESPN.com. Zach Lowe, while I have you, I want to ask you about something. Michael Jordan's longtime agent, David Falk, said earlier this week that if Michael played today, he would average, quote, between 50 and 60 a game. What do you think?
With respect to David Falk, I think that's a little much. Now, look, he averaged 37 and 35 in separate years. So, and we just saw James Harden chase 40 a couple times. So I don't think it's crazy to say a Michael Jordan with no hand checking, with no bad boys throwing him on the floor, shooting more threes off the dribble probably, can get to 40 in a couple of years. But 50, 60, I think the one thing that is often overlooked in this discussion is all of those times Michael catches the ball in the mid post and does his little arch back thing and goes to work. back in those days, because of the illegal defense rules, you had to either single cover him or send really hard double teams, and it was easier to read. Now they've essentially made zone defense legal, so you could do all sorts of tricky things and half helps and double and triple rotations. Scoring one-on-one out of the post is harder today than it was then, and that's not just because players aren't as skilled at it. It's because they changed the rules to make it harder. So I don't think 50 or 60 is super realistic, but I think a run or two at 40 is totally in play.
Jalen, if Michael Jordan played in the NBA today, what are you shaking your head for? What do you think?
Well, I have some simple math for everybody out there. First off, just look at the greatness of James Harden currently. He's averaging like 36. Okay, he's getting none of those off of how he plays defense. Just think about Michael Jordan is going to be getting steals. He's going to be getting blocks. He's going to be getting breakaway dunks. He's probably the most athletic player that the game has seen. And he averaged 35 then. So just think about this, Greeny. In today's era, I'll give him one more basket a quarter. Just one more basket a quarter. That's 8 points. I'll give him one trip to the line each quarter. That's 2, 4, 6, 8. That's 8 points. That's 16. He getting close to 50. So I would say the way Wilt had an assault on the record book, and you know, Greedy, we've been talking about this for over 2 decades.
Yep.
Michael Jordan would have been that player that would have been hovering close to 50, and we would have been talking about somebody doing what Wilt did. So I'll say like 47 and a half is what Michael Jordan would have.
I think I agree. Again, I strongly recommend Zach Lowe's piece. It's on ESPN.com right now. Zach, it is great to see you again, and we'll talk again soon. Thank you, my man. Jalen's coming back a little bit later. And another reminder, don't miss it Sunday night, the series everyone is talking about everywhere. It's Last Dance. Episodes 5 and 6 come your way this Sunday night, starting 9 Eastern on ESPN. On November 18th of 2018, the Washington Redskins were in first place in their division heading into a Week 11 game against Houston. On the first possession of the third quarter, everything changed for that organization, for their new starting quarterback, Alex Smith, too. Here's an excerpt from the upcoming E60 special, Project 11, which debuts tonight.
As I go down, I didn't hear anything. It went fuzzy.
I think I remember saying, like, you're right, you know, big fella. This look on his face was, he knew it was something serious.
I asked the coach next to me what happened. I thought it was a concussion or something. I didn't know. Somebody else next to him said, I saw it. His leg's in two different places.
To know immediately your leg's broken, bending where it shouldn't bend, certainly is a unusual sight.
See the entire feature. Check out Project 11 presented by E60 tonight, 7:30 Eastern on ESPN and on the ESPN app. Coming up, the legendary quarterback may be angry. His drafted successor might be in an odd position. How should the coach handle it? We'll talk about that and more. We start a new hour of Get Up next.